This has been the hottest summer on record in many East Coast cities and many other parts of the country. That heat has brought with it a lot of days with unhealthy air. At least 75 areas from Portland, Maine to San Francisco are warning residents to expect high air pollution today. Here's NPR's Elizabeth Shogren with our report.
All the bad air days mean that at daycare centers like Little Flowers in Washington, D.C., children are spending a lot of time cooped up inside.
And now we're taking them outside for 15 minutes so they can play with the sprinkler.
Ileana Noguchi says the children normally would go to the playground several times a day for 40 minutes each time. But with code red air quality, they get one short recess.
Ready? Go! Who's going to be the brave one? Come on, let's go!
As tiny feet slap the pavement in a happy sprinkler dance, Noguchi says some toddlers are missing. They have asthma, and their parents pick them up early to avoid even this brief time outside. Norman Edelman, the chief medical officer for the American Lung Association, says children are especially vulnerable to bad air days, particularly if they have asthma.
Kids are always running around, so they breathe a lot more for their size than adults do. So they take in more of this bad stuff.
That means that even healthy children should limit their time outside on code orange days when the air is unhealthy for sensitive groups, and on code red days when the air is bad for everyone. Ozone and fine particles are the two types of pollution that trigger code red and orange days. Both are formed out of the exhaust from power plants, cars, and a lot of other things. Edelman says with ozone,
the two bad chemical actors are oxides of nitrogen and hydrocarbons. When they're exposed to heat and sunlight, a chemical reaction takes place which releases ozone.
And when people breathe it in, it irritates their lungs.
So if you look down the airway of somebody exposed to excessive ozone, it would look like a bad sunburn of the airways.
And since children's airways are a lot smaller than adults, it doesn't take much swelling to cause an asthma attack. High levels of fine particles also trigger bad air days in summertime, especially in the east. Coal-fired power plants are the main culprit, and on the hottest days, they're working at full tilt to keep air conditioners running. The elderly and people with lung and heart problems are at high risk, but Edelman says even if you're healthy, you shouldn't ignore bad air days. It's probably best to do outdoor exercise in the morning before the sun and exhaust have turned the air into an unhealthy soup. Not at, say, 5 p.m. when two teams of federal workers are slugging it out on a steamy softball field.
Come on, Dwight. Come on.
So I know two other teams played it safe today and called the next two games off. So, and it's not that bad out here.
Army Corps of Engineers shortstop Matt Unger says his players are used to the heat after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh, good. That's
turns out their opponents, self-described bureaucrats from the Government Accountability Office, are pretty tough, too. Still panting from her run around the bases, Kim Giannopoulos admits that, like a lot of other people, she doesn't pay much attention to air pollution alerts.
You don't get too much opportunity these days to get out and have fun with your coworkers and do this kind of thing, so got to take advantage of it, you know.
Dr. Edelman says if you do exert yourself on bad air days, don't ignore symptoms like burning lungs or irritated eyes. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
The real estate market in much of the United States continues to struggle, but you can travel a relatively short distance and see a big difference. Just crossed the border to Canada. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Vancouver is often considered one of the world's most livable cities. Spectacular scenery, cultural diversity, great restaurants, a vibrant waterfront, and high-rises dotting the skyline. A new one is going up right now in the middle of downtown.
It's a 38-story with rooftop deck.
David Kennedy is the site superintendent here.
It's office space from 5 to 12 and residential from 14 to 36.
And is there demand for more housing downtown?
There seems to be. They're still selling.
Unlike the U.S., Canada doesn't have huge inventories of unsold properties or foreclosures dragging down the market.
If one looks at the difference between the United States and Canada, you have to look at what went on in housing finance.
Sewer Somerville of the University of British Columbia's Souder School of Business says Canada did not have an explosion of subprime lending.
culturally, institutionally, the type of lending frameworks, everything here in Canada made that more difficult to get going.
Canadian bankers are often characterized as stodgy, and they were more careful about lending money. Cameron Muir of the British Columbia Real Estate Association adds they didn't encourage unqualified buyers to jump into the market.
I have yet to see an introductory teaser rate in Canada. We didn't have such things.
Canadians generally put more money down than their U.S. peers, and there is no tax break for mortgage interest. Moreover, says Muir, buyers who put 20% or less down have to get mortgage insurance, and the government sets the criteria for borrowers.
That means that you're going to have another set of eyes look at how you're going to qualify for that mortgage. And of course, those mortgage insurance companies have a vested interest in making sure that that mortgage is going to be paid and doesn't go into arrears.
The result? Fewer bad loans. Another difference. Canadian banks typically write 5-year, not 30-year loans, and they often hold on to those loans rather than sell them to investors. Canada did feel the effects of the global recession, and housing prices did tumble about 15% between 2008 and early 2009. But for the most part, prices in Canada rebounded quickly. Real estate agent Robert Valeriot says in some places, including Vancouver, prices actually rose.
I think it was pent-up demand. People were hearing all the bad news coming out of, you know, our neighbors down in the States and this and that, and everyone took a step back, and then everyone jumped back in, and the demand was outrageous, and the prices just skyrocketed.
Prices have declined a bit since the first quarter of the year, and sales are down a bit, but the market remains solid, and concerns about a housing bubble have subsided. Cascading water adorns the entry to this luxury condo, originally built as part of the recent Vancouver Olympics.
The floor is an engineered hardwood.
Joanna Critico shows off a first-floor unit, which felt a bit like being in a goldfish bowl. It was priced at over $1 million. Two not very big bedrooms and a 4.5-foot wide space, euphemistically called a flex space. Vancouver real estate agent Valeriot and I took a peek.
You could use it as either a walk-in closet, a storage, or a home office. I've seen lots of home offices built into rooms this size.
Spaces are small because land is pricey and scarce, and lots of people want to live here, including a steady stream of wealthy Asian immigrants who want to buy homes. What's more, many Asians are investing in Canadian real estate, and that, too, has helped the country's real estate market continue to hum. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. When Deborah Fallows went to live in China with her husband, the journalist James Fallows, she was armed with a few semesters of Mandarin study. Then she got to Shanghai and found she couldn't recognize or speak a single word of what she'd been studying. She writes about her journey through the Chinese language and her many missteps along the way in her new book, Dreaming in Chinese. Deborah Fallows has a PhD in linguistics and speaks half a dozen languages, but Chinese was another story.
I didn't feel like I had anything to hang my hat on with this language. It just bore no resemblance to Romance languages, Germanic languages, Japanese, anything that I'd ever approached before. And there are some things about Chinese that are easy, and then there are a lot of things about Chinese that are hard.
Well, let's talk about that. You point out that Chinese has only 400 syllables, unique syllables, one-tenth of the number that there are in English, which means that there are many, many, many words that sound exactly alike. And that can get you into a lot of trouble, right?
Its homonyms run rampant. Yeah, like in English, if you have, say, the word seal the animal, you have seal a letter. But in Chinese, you have just a plethora of things like that. The issue with Chinese is that they have these very few syllables. You don't, words like ma, ta, he, shi, you don't get a lot of long, complicated syllables like stretch or plump, where you get consonants clustered together to give you all kinds of variety. So there's very little to work with. And that actually connects directly to the tone system of Chinese. Since you have so few syllables to work with, one of the ways out of that in distinguishing one syllable for another to make one word or another is to slap a tone onto it. So you can say, sure, 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 sure.
And you the get meaning four, will change.
And the meaning will change with each of those.
You print a short little story in your book, written in Chinese, called The Lion-Eating Poet in the Stone Den.
That's right.
Which looks like a whole bunch of different Chinese characters on the page. But if you were to read it, what would it sound like?
It would sound all like sure.
Every word.
Every word is sure. The tones might change, but the amazing thing about this poem is that you can tell this entire story using one syllable. It's a real challenge to listen to, especially if your ear is not accustomed to listening and using tones.
And the shu in this poem, you're saying, means lions, market, ten, eat, and stone, among other words.
Right, among other things. It's a little fable, and it's not a great story, and it doesn't tell a wonderful myth. But it is kind of interesting that you can tell a whole story using one syllable.
You write about something that happened to you one day when you had a craving, an inexplicable craving for cheese when you were living in Shanghai, and you went to Taco Bell, and you were trying to order takeout. And just ran into a buzzsaw of lack of understanding. What happened?
Right. I went in the door and was greeted by this young Chinese guy in a sombrero and little velvet vest and had practiced very hard what I was going to ask him. I wanted to do takeout. The word in Chinese for takeout is da bao. So I wasn't very good at tones at that point. And trying to ask him, do you have da bao? A complete blank look on his face. So I thought, okay, I'm obviously using the tones wrong here, so I'll try da bao with other kinds of tones. So I was trying rising tones, falling and rising tones, any combination of tones I could get for the word da bao. Then I got the menu. I started mimicking, pointing on the menu, pointing to the door as though I were taking a bag out the door, you know, and thinking all of this, well, come on, how hard can this be? Finally, he went into the back room, into the kitchen, and came out with three or four other guys. I went through the routine again with da bao, da bao, da bao, anything I could think of. And one of them had this look of eureka on his face, and he said, oh, da bao. And then they all laughed and went into the other room and said, yes, they do. You know, yes, they do. Yo, they do have da bao.
And when you were asking in that Taco Bell for takeout, they might have been thinking, what? What would have sounded similar to what you were asking for?
There are a number of things, some of them more embarrassing than others. I was maybe asking for a hug, and I, of course...
These crazy Westerners. Yeah. You just never know what they'll want. You point up one other thing that well, many other things, but you do point to one glimmer you have into Chinese culture, which has to do with the notion that it can be a very blunt language. To an American, it might seem impolite that there aren't sort of these grace notes, I think you call them, of please and thank you that are added to things.
Right. When people ask you if you want something, like would you like a glass of water, you'd say, bu yao, which just means don't want or don't need, instead of saying, oh, no, thanks, I'm not really thirsty now. Maybe I'll have something later.
Right.
With all this padding and softness that you use to communicate in what you think is a polite way in English, you strip all of that away in Chinese, and it's just 不要, 不可以, don't want, cannot, 不是, isn't, do not. And I did feel very rude. But then I noticed this funny thing that was going on. For example, if you're in a restaurant watching a group of close friends eating, or maybe it's a family eating, you see this very delicate choreography. For example, you have a common pot of chicken, and maybe the mom in the family's got her chopstick, and she's very delicately picking out the best little chunks of chicken to put on her child's plate. And you see the dad pouring tea or pouring beer for everybody else in the family, as is appropriate, before pouring it for yourself. So you think this is very polite, normal, standard behavior. And then in the midst of all this, one of the kids will say, "Gei wo yan, give me the salt." I thought, what's going on? Why this point of difference between what you see as polite and what you hear as being really rude? So I started to look into this a little bit and found that if you're inserting these niceties, these softeners like pleases and thank yous, the Chinese will see that as actually setting up a distance between you and the person you're talking to. So if I say, please pass the salt, you're understanding that I have a certain degree of formality between you and me, which you don't want to insert in that case. So in a family or between and among friends, putting in the pleases and thank yous actually is setting up a distance between you that is a degree of formality and even can be kind of offensive, rather than saying, hey, what's going on here? You know, you're my buddy, you're my friend. You don't need to say please and thank you. That's what's polite, is when you strip away that kind of formality of please and thank you.
I'm wondering if you got to the point where you were, in fact, dreaming in Chinese, which is the title of your book. Were you seeing characters? Was that the language in your sleep?
I dreamed a little in Chinese, but not a lot in Chinese. It was more like this odd dictionary dream where I was looking for a word. It was more like this frustrating experience with the tones where I was trying to say something and get it across and someone not understanding me.
Pretty much the story of your time there.
The story of my life in China.
Deborah Fellows, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Melissa.
Deborah Fellows' book is Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. You can read an excerpt at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now to someone who helps women make those decisions. Dr. Kenneth Offit is chief of the Clinical Genetics Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Dr. Offit, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Elsa.
And will this new study, do you think, change how you counsel your patients who do test for these genetic mutations, who do have the mutations?
Well, so we published a similar study 8 years ago at Sloan Kettering based on our experience, and at that time people said that the surgery options were too drastic. Now we have this report today from 20 centers, and this confirms powerfully that genetic testing as well as surgery together are a powerful strategy to prevent breast and ovarian cancer.
So more data for women to think about if they're considering having surgery. Do you think this bolsters the case for going ahead and having the surgery?
I think, it's very persuasive data. You still have to keep in mind, if you look at this paper, that still 90% of the women, even in this study, opted not to have the breast surgery. So it's still a very difficult decision. The breast decision is one which is highly personalized. The ovarian surgery is one which we feel much more strongly about. Only 40% of the women in the study opted for it. At Sloan Kettering, we are aiming more to 80%, and that's because we really don't have any means to screen for ovarian cancers, which we do have for breast cancer.
So in other words, you feel more strongly about it, meaning you would counsel it because the screening for ovarian cancer is not great.
Exactly right, Alyssa. If we don't have a screening test for ovarian cancer, and most ovarian cancers will present at an advanced stage, we call it stage 3 and 4. In fact, the only really early stage ovarian cancers I saw at Sloan Kettering after a decade occurred after we started doing this type of BRCA testing. We found that when we did the preventive ovarian surgery, 3% of the time we did a preventive surgery, we would find a microscopic, small, and curable ovarian cancer. And this is, I think, a very powerful argument to be going ahead and doing this laparoscopic surgery. It's not difficult surgery to have.
Mm-hmm. How common are these mutations, Dr. Offit?
The mutations aren't terribly common. We think probably 1 in 400 women in the general population. But there are some populations in the world. I actually describe the most common mutation of BRCA2, and that occurs in individuals of Eastern European Jewish ancestry, Ashkenazi Jews. And in the Eastern European Jewish group, and also in some other groups, such as those in Iceland, we have very high rates in the Jewish group. For example, 1 in 40 individuals, not 1 in 400, will carry a BRCA mutation.
Mm-hmm. When you're counseling women on possible surgery, how do you factor in the age of the patient and the age of potential onset of the disease? I mean, a younger woman might want to know, look, am I at risk for cancer now, or are we talking about something that might happen when I'm 80?
And this is really, I think, the difficult issue, because women are at their active phases just exactly when they need to have these surgeries. So the onset here for breast and ovarian cancer is much earlier. We're talking about the 30s or the 40s and ovarian cancer by age 50. So we advise the ovarian surgery as soon as childbearing is completed.
And you would advise genetic testing, too, for men with strong family history?
Yes, that's right. For men who have a family history of breast or ovarian cancer, we also advise the genetic testing. And that's because the males, the men, are particularly prone to developing prostate cancer. We did a study earlier this year that showed that the men who develop prostate cancer will develop it sometimes in a more aggressive form. So if you're a man and your sister had breast cancer, your mother had ovarian cancer, you also need to have BRCA testing.
Okay. Dr. Offit, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Kenneth Offit is chief of the Clinical Genetics Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The Justice Department says there has been an explosion in the trafficking of child pornography. While the government has pledged to step up its investigation of people who download the illegal images, it has hardly been neglecting the problem. Since 2000, the number of federal prosecutions has almost tripled. As NPR's Martin Costi reports, that has some asking if more could be done to prevent people from downloading the images to begin with.
In September of 2004, a family in Northern California got a visit from the FBI.
I get a call from my wife. She's crying and upset. And so I went home, and there were several agents going through my house who stated that there was, you know, child porn on one of the computers.
This is Dave. We're leaving out his last name because he has the kind of job that could be jeopardized by any mention of child pornography. In this case, the images were on a computer used by his 20-year-old son. His son is now in prison, serving a 3-year sentence for one count of possessing child pornography. Dave still can't get over the damage that was done by some computer files.
We have a young kid that has no criminal history, is not a pedophile, is not a child molester, and he's going to be labeled as a sex offender and have to register as such every year on his birthday for the rest of his life.
Of course, these aren't just any computer files. Jeff Fishback is a forensic analyst who works with this kind of material, and he's seen what happens when these images are shown to juries.
You can watch the expressions change. I saw one gentleman in the front row of the jury, I think he was number 3, and I saw him lurch forward toward the defendant.
Defendants almost never risk going to trial. Lawyers usually recommend they take a plea bargain. It's Fishback's job to analyze the hard drives in these cases, and when he does, he follows strict protocols, as if the drives contained plutonium.
It is handled like it's radioactive.
He keeps the drives in special locked boxes, even when they're running, and he never connects them to the internet or other computers for fear of cross-contamination. His job has taught him the legal jeopardy that can be caused by even one stray thumbnail image. And yet, he says, the very same files can be found on the open internet quite easily.
Oh, right now, anybody is just one search term and a click on Google away from most of the same files that I have seen as part of my work.
Fishback has come to believe that these easy-to-find images are a kind of public hazard. He thinks about one case he worked on for a defendant who went to prison because of just one night of ill-advised web surfing. The easy-to-find images are also tempting weapons in messy custody battles and divorces. He's convinced that in some of the cases he's worked on, one spouse was framed by another. All of this makes Fishback wonder why more hasn't been done to block some of the more obvious sources of these radioactive files.
It's the same thing as any other public nuisance. Part of the government's job is not just to go out there and stop people from doing bad things, but to stop good people from having to fall victim to that.
It's probably not constitutional for the government to block offending websites outright, but Fishback says internet service providers and search engines could voluntarily filter the images that reach their customers, just as email providers filter out known viruses. He's been suggesting this idea for years, and now somebody's trying it.
I have a photo. I'm going to open it so you can see. It's a picture of a truck with a duck.
John Scarrow is general manager for Windows Live Safety Services. In a conference room on the Microsoft campus in Redmond, Washington, Scarrow demonstrates something they call photo DNA.
Now, clearly this is not a piece of child pornography, but we've tagged this and created an image as though it was.
Garrow then tries to upload the picture to Microsoft's cloud computing service called SkyDrive. The numeric value of that photo, something called a hash value, is checked against a master list of known child pornography photos that's maintained by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. If the photo matches one of those,
it disabled the account. This error you're seeing is a placeholder error for the fact that this account has been disabled.
Microsoft is using a more flexible version of traditional hash values, and that means it can ID an image even if the picture has been cropped or resized. This flexibility takes some heavy math, and that means the system can't be used to filter the whole internet. That would take just too much computing power. But Scarrow says filtering everything was never the point.
Somebody that's smart enough that really wants to traffic in the material will figure out how to circumvent these. But the, if you will, the person that is getting a hold of it because it's really easy to get a hold of, you know, is just looking around, whatever, this will have a, we believe this will have a pretty substantial impact on them.
The filtering system is already running on the Bing search engine. If your search finds a site with known child pornography, those links are suppressed. Microsoft is planning to expand the filter to its other online services, and it's offering to share photo DNA free of charge with other online portals. And the project has the support of the Justice Department. Tentative support.
I think it's fair to say that it may be part of an answer.
Drew Osterbahn runs the Criminal Division's Child Exploitation and Obscenity section. He says file filtering could become, in his words, another front in the battle, but he says there could also be unforeseen consequences. One possibility, he says, is that the filtering could work too well. If child pornography became too hard to find, he says, it might create demand for new images and cause more children to be abused.
That's why this is a very, very challenging area of law enforcement, where, you know, in the past 10 years, I've never found any real simple solutions.
For now, filtering images with photo DNA is a pilot project, and it's purely voluntary. One thing its developers insist on is that they don't want to see it evolve into a filtering system that's mandated by the government. Martin Costi, NPR News.